The Center for Constitutional Rights has provided legal counsel for Guantanamo Bay detainees and for people deported shortly after September 11, 2001. Now attorneys at the center have every reason to suspect that their communication with their clients has been monitored by the U.S. government. In December, a New York Times report identified the existence of a secret domestic surveillance program being carried out by the U.S. National Security Agency. In the context of the so-called war on terrorism, the NSA has been monitoring communication into and out of the United States without seeking the warrants required under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The Center for Constitutional Rights and the American Civil Liberties Union have both filed lawsuits against the U.S. government over what they say is an illegal program. We've been joined on the phone by Shaina Cadidal, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Hello, Shaina.
Good morning, Karen.
Since the New York Times first broke the story of the surveillance program in December, what have you learned about how this program operates?
The first press conference that the Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez gave about the program indicated that it was, you know, sort of a targeted program, and they've started, you know, even calling it a terrorist surveillance program. And so what Gonzalez said was, you know, look, this is only calls that either enter or exit the United States that are being monitored, calls and emails, and it's only situations where we think one person on either end of the line is either a member of Al-Qaeda or affiliated with Al-Qaeda or affiliated with a group that is affiliated with Al-Qaeda, so some link to terrorism, although they gave themselves a lot of leeway. They're trying to sell it as something that's very sort of targeted and kind of a rapid response sort of program, something that moves faster than getting warrants from the FISA court is what, you know, they initially said about it. But there have been a lot of media reports that it actually may go much further than that, that it may be, you know, something in, along the order of a data mining program where, you know, apparently now the technology exists where, you know, the government can scan every single phone call potentially for the presence of, say, one word in Arabic or, you know, one particular word or read every email with, you know, have computers scan every email for the presence of one word, that sort of thing. So it may be the case that this is really a program that is much faster than they're talking about. The media reports and what the government have said are kind of at odds with each other.
Any idea how many people have been monitored so far?
The media reports have quoted government sources as saying, you know, it's about 5,000 to 7,000 people overseas and maybe about 500 people inside the U.S. But when I say that, I mean those are the people who are the targets of the surveillance. So it may be that every call that those people are making is being monitored, even if the program is as limited in scope as the president has said it is. So, you know, if one person calls, you know, 100 people in the course of a month, you know, pretty quickly you're talking about thousands and thousands of people who've been monitored.
Do you know if the Center for Constitutional Rights has been a surveillance target?
Well, you know, no one really knows whether or not they've been a target of this program, with the exception of one or two terrorism suspects, well, actually people who, you know, pled guilty or were convicted. And the government has only told, you know, the media that those people were targets of it because they wanted to sort of say, look, you know, this program works. It helped us, you know, get these two people. But, you know, for the most part, it's a secret surveillance program, and no one has any documentary evidence that they were targets of the program. But we feel we fit pretty closely with the pattern of people that they say they are targeting. So, for instance, you know, we represent the Guantanamo detainees. We represent people who were swept up, you know, undocumented aliens here in the United States right after 9/11 and tagged with, you know, sort of, you know, suspicion of being involved somehow with the 9/11 attacks because they were Muslims. And then we represent Mr. Arar, who I guess is well known to your listeners up in Canada, a person who the United States stopped while he was, you know, changing flights at JFK Airport on his way back to Canada and sent back not to the country of his citizenship, Canada, but rather to Syria for the purposes of being tortured for 10 months. Now we have to communicate with all of these people who are all located outside the U.S. or with witnesses in their cases or with other human rights lawyers in their cases located outside the U.S. And we feel that those communications fit the model of what the Attorney General has said this program is kind of targeted at, you know, communications with people who the government has suspected at some time of some link to terrorism.
And is this why you decided to file the lawsuit against the U.S. government?
Well, that's part of it, but our suit isn't completely dependent on the idea that we, you know, we must have been targets of this program. You know, it's really basically, you know, predicated on the idea that that we are civil rights lawyers whose stock in trade is suing the government over its detention and interrogation practices in the war on terror. And it makes it very difficult for us to bring cases like that involving clients or witnesses or other co-counsel located outside of the United States when all those people know that if they call us or email us from, you know, outside the U.S. in the course of, you know, litigating their cases, that those conversations might be listened to by the government. You know, we have kind of an ethical obligation to disclose to people who we're working with that, look, you know, international calls, you know, this program, you know, may be able to target them, and the government may basically be listening over our shoulders. And so you're going to have to be careful about what you tell us over the you know, electronic means of communication. And you know, that makes us look suspect. It may make the client less willing to bring litigation in the first place. It just makes it really difficult for us to bring the kind of lawsuits that we bring. And so that really is kind of the central harm that we're alleging that this program creates. It's basically that the existence of the program makes it difficult for us to sue the government and hold the government accountable for its practices in the war on terror.
And so the government is breaking the law by violating the attorney-client privilege?
Well, you know, that's basically, you know, part of it. I mean, we have a First Amendment protected interest, the Supreme Court has said in the past, in bringing this kind of litigation. It's very clear, by the way, that the law has been broken here. You know, none of the justifications that the government has put forward for, you know, to defend the legality of the program really make any sense. And Congress, you know, passed a statute, FISA, in 1978 at the end of the Watergate era here in the U.S., you know, to basically ensure that no wiretapping could take place except for what was authorized by statute. And that's basically what the president has done here.
What remedies are you requesting through the lawsuit?
Well, you know, obviously we'd like an order from the court that the program stop, but we also want full disclosure to us of whether or not we were targets of, of surveillance. We want disclosure of what records they have of you know, eavesdropping on our conversations and emails and so forth, and then we want destruction of their records, which is a real important thing. You know, if Congress decides, you know, that this is too politically damaging to the Republican Party or to the president and tries to validate the program by some sort of, you know, retroactive legislation, we feel that we can still, you know, get some of that relief retrospectively and get a court ruling as part of that that the program was unlawful, unconstitutional, and so forth.
Since the program was made public, both George Bush and Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General, have defended it vigorously. And one of their arguments is that surveillance was approved by Congress as part of its authorization to use military force in Afghanistan. What's your response to that argument?
That argument is really, you know, it's very disingenuous. I mean, in the very first press conference, Alberto Gonzalez said that the administration had thought about asking Congress for approval of changes to the existing statutes that would make this NSA program legal, but they didn't ask because they knew they were going to get rejected. So it's kind of disingenuous for the administration to say on the one hand that Congress implicitly approved of this program when it authorized the president to use force against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, but at the same time say that, you know, they thought Congress wouldn't have explicitly approved of it. So I don't even think Alberto Gonzalez believes that argument, but there are other reasons to think it's false as well. I mean, Congress made a lot of fine adjustments to the statutes in December of 2001, you know, a month or two after the authorization to use force, and I don't think they would have done that if they thought they had authorized wholesale surveillance. And, you know, the speed argument that the administration made at the outset was also really very disingenuous. The FISA statute allows the government to go to a judge and ask for a warrant retroactively within 72 hours of instituting wiretapping. And there's really nothing faster than a retroactive warrant, so that argument doesn't make very much sense either. And then finally, there's one that the president put forward in his State of the Union address, which is that we might have caught the hijackers of 9/11 if this program had been in place before 9/11. In fact, the NSA knew that two hijackers, Khalid al-Madar and Nawaf al-Hamzi, were in San Diego prior to the attacks because they had a legal wiretap on a safe house in Yemen, an al-Qaeda safe house, and yet they didn't pass that information on to other agencies because they failed to appreciate its significance. So what we really had there was a failure of information sharing between intelligence agencies, the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA, and not a failure of the statutes. It wasn't the fact the statutes were too strict.
You've been forced to work within the confines of the USA Patriot Act and now this surveillance program. How has this climate impacted your ability to do the work of protecting constitutional and human rights?
Well, you know, it's difficult to say because, you know, it creates I mean, the most, you know, obviously we as lawyers, we're used to the idea that, you know, the government in the past may have spied on attorneys. You know, historically, you know, administrations have used surveillance powers against their political opponents. That's one reason the FISA law was written, because President Nixon and President Johnson used it to spy on, used wiretapping to spy on anti-war activists, on civil rights leaders like Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, it's one reason we filed this case the day after the King holiday here in the U.S. But, you know, what you really worry about is the sort of chilling effect on potential clients out there. You know, it may be the case that people aren't approaching us or are less willing to start litigation because they are worried about becoming targets of surveillance. There may be people, you know, say volunteer translators in Arabic, that kind of thing, who may not want to work with us because they are worried that they will become suspects and then their calls and the calls of anyone associated with them might be subject to surveillance. So it's that kind of effect that we really have, you know, we'll have difficulty measuring it. That's what we're really worried about, that kind of broader chilling effect. You know, it's the people that don't come to us, the people that don't call us, that we don't really have a sense for they're being scared off by this program, and that's the biggest worry, I think.
The question doesn't seem to be whether the government is spying, but why they're actually doing this. Where do you think the government is ultimately trying to go with this program?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I mean, you know, we like to say about this case that it's the rare case where we know, you know, more about the law than the facts when we start out. You know, and we know it's clearly illegal, but the big mysteries are who they were spying on and why they were doing it. And I guess there's three justifications that we've kind of batted around as possibilities. You know, one is basically that this administration has a long-term agenda of advancing executive power. You know, so they don't want to be put, they don't want to, you know, they want to be able to say that they don't have to ask a court for approval for warrants. They want to be able to say they don't have to ask Congress for a new statute, that this should just be within the president's power, but, you know, and that makes sense. The president should have that power in the interest of national security. You know, Vice President Cheney has said, you know, that there was a vast erosion of presidential power in the Watergate era and that this administration wants to reverse it. So that's one possible explanation. A second explanation is that it may be a vast data mining program of the sort that, you know, would really seem so creepy to the American public that they might not accept it. You know, so the administration has vehemently denied that they are trying to scan every single phone call for individual words or read every single email that goes in and out of the U.S. But if they are doing that, that would be so, you know, sort of far afield of what the Fourth Amendment permits that I don't think there's any way that it could pass, you know, constitutional muster. And so it may be the case that is really what this program is about, and they want to hide that from the voting public and also from the courts because neither one would ever approve of it. And then finally, it may be that they are, you know, in fact, engaging in surveillance that even conservative judges on the FISA court would never approve wiretaps for, you know, conversations of attorneys with their clients or conversations of journalists with their sources. And, you know, it's possible that the program was at least partially motivated by the desire to make it more difficult for people abroad to litigate challenges to this administration's practices in the war on terror. So those are the three, you know, sort of leading candidates for an explanation here, but it really is a mystery because it seems like they could have done an awful lot of this using FISA, using the existing statute.
Well, thank you for speaking with me, Shana.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Shana Katidel. He's with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. Their website is ccr-ny.org. And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.